As mentioned yesterday, we have a standard setting project with respect to communications with audit committees, where we are in the process of looking at that existing standard, and we see the opportunity to improve the standard on communications from auditors with audit committees, and therefore we put a briefing paper together for the SAG and a discussion topic today to go over this and to get your input. Barbara Vanich, to my left, Associate Chief Auditor, will lead this discussion. Barbara?
Thank you, Marty. Communications with audit committees has been discussed with this group on several occasions, back in June 2004 and again through a panel discussion in October of 2005. In addition, SAG members have provided input on this topic during discussions of risk assessment, audit quality indicators, and going concern. This input is one of the primary reasons we are currently looking at a project on this topic. We hope to take your input from the past, as well as input we ask for today on several specific topics to potentially consider in a new standard or in revisions to the existing standard. Since this topic has generated so much input and seems to be of relative interest to many SAG members, we thought it would be appropriate to start today by calling on several members to give us some opening remarks. Jamie Miller, Peggy Foran, and Lynn Turner. After their remarks, we'll allow time for any other opening comments before moving to the first discussion topic. With that, Jamie, do you mind getting us started?
Sure. You know, the topic of required communication with the audit committees is an interesting one. And as we look back, I think it's important to note that the auditing standards around auditor communication we've had have really withstood the test of time and have been further bolstered and supported by enhanced good governance behaviors as a result of Sarbanes-Oxley. But I do think, given the events of the last year and, you know, just given all that's transpired, it's a good point in time to ask ourselves the question about whether what we're doing could be improved and whether we ought to be doing something different. And personally, I agree it could be improved. You know, the current auditing standards require communications between the auditors and the audit committee on a number of different topics, and the most important of which I think really are around the significant accounting policies, the management judgments and estimates, and most importantly, the auditor's judgments about the quality of a company's accounting principles. And there's a lot of latitude in terms of how the standard is written for the audit committee to use, the auditor to use judgment in determining what's appropriate to be discussed with the audit committee. In fact, the standard expects use of that judgment, which I think is appropriate given that companies, committees, and cultures are all very different. There are, though, a number of other potentially relevant topics as we consider the last 12 months. I think the challenge really is many of them are more operational in nature, and some of them are more financial and are areas where the auditor would have a strong basis for engaging in a dialogue. You know, for example, on the operational side, we think of risk, liquidity, leverage, compliance, tax, you know, all topics that are very, very important board and sometimes audit committee topics, but not necessarily ones that the auditor per se has a basis for comment on. But others where I think we could consider, you know, broadening our standard or thinking differently could be disclosures. You talked about that a little bit over the last half hour. You know, I do think auditors are challenged sometimes to really assess the qualitative aspects of disclosures like we talked about. Really assess whether they're appropriate and balanced, whether there should be more information, maybe less, and really frame up a good discussion with the audit committee on the quality of those disclosures. Sensitivities and judgments is also an area where perhaps we could provide some additional best practice examples to enhance those communications. And information about the auditing firm is clearly something from a governance perspective that I think is important for audit committees to consider. The real challenge, though, is how to ensure the communications, when they occur, are robust. And I've heard the complaint that required communications tend to be more boilerplate, you know, sort of compliance-oriented documents. And in some cases, this may be true. You know, the real challenge is that the rules are carried out by people. And when I think back on my own experience, you know, the most informative discussions come from dialogues from informal sessions, from active debates, but not necessarily from a list, per se, of required communications. And to me, the real question is, how can, you know, the PCOB help drive robust behavior, which is a much more complicated, frankly, issue to drive. You know, I've been the chief accounting officer now for three different public companies, and in each instance, the audit committee communication, both with management and the auditors, was very robust, you know, very, very active, both in debate and dialogue, and very appropriate. But it really gets down to the people involved in the process and the candor and rigor which with they apply the rules. You know, AU 380 and the IASB have written rules or have written rules requiring that the auditors sit down with the audit committee and discuss the audit committee communication process, execute the process, evaluate the results of that process. I think focus on process is important because it ensures the dialogue about how well we're communicating. And it's important because the dialogue forces a reconciliation when it's not. My concern, though, about how the rules are written are that it could be construed as a one-way communication, meaning the way they're written today, the auditor informs the committee about the timing and form of communications. The auditor communicates, and then the auditor self-evaluates how that communication is going. And perhaps there's an opportunity for us to change that such that it requires a dialogue, a robust dialogue between the two parties to establish expectations around communications and when and how those occur. And then at the end, the requirement to together evaluate how those communications are occurring and whether they're robust to meet the expectations of the board in carrying out the responsibilities of the auditor and the audit committee. I think another opportunity is to consider also publishing a companion document that shares effective practices in communications. You know, one of the biggest challenges in trying to drive behavior is that everybody is different. Each company will have a different emphasis, a different culture. Auditors themselves have different personalities in terms of how they engage with people. And I think if we had a companion document or some form of effective practices that people could use as they engage in this dialogue and debate, it could also drive, I think, the desired result. You know, best practices tend to emerge from the principle of sort of consistent, open communications with audit committee constituents. You know, and as an example, some companies engage in things like monthly meetings with the engagement partner and the chairman of the audit committee one-on-one in person for an hour or two to really talk informally about observations, independent views on what's going on at the company, accounting or auditing implications. I've also seen audit committee chairs extend that same practice to certain members of management that they wouldn't otherwise typically meet in those forums, you know, whether it's the chief accounting officer, the internal audit head. You know, quarterly meetings before earnings releases, some companies do this, not all do, provides for a very robust discussion about the issues of the day or significant judgments in applying accounting or auditing judgment in the quarter. And certainly executive sessions. But, you know, this list is obviously just a few of what I'm sure are many really effective practices out there. But I think if the PCOB did a study of those, they could actually really help enhance both how audit committees can carry out their roles, but give the auditor some tools to help move the right behaviors in the process.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Peggy, would you mind going next?
Well, Jamie, thank you. You just said everything I had prepared, so now I have to find some new things to say. One thing I want to point out is, last we spoke was October 2005, and I think much has happened since that period of time. I, too, have been in a lot of accounting and a lot of audit committee meetings, and I, at least the ones I've been in, and I really do believe that that the audit committee is getting it, and they're recognizing their responsibilities and the governance, and there is a lot of dialogue. So I agree with Jamie. We should be really focusing on how we can get the best and qualitative dialogue. I think there have been a lot of other governance improvements. I think the executive sessions have just been, I can't begin to say how I think they've improved, not only with the accountants, but with general counsels, et cetera. And so I've seen major, major improvements. You know, I personally am very big on communication. I'm also a supporter of effective and robust two-way communication. So I do believe that we can enhance the existing requirement related to management's judgments and estimates. Jamie, I like your way about you know, publishing best practices. I think that that would work very well. You know, there are various groups right now, too, with chairs of audit committees, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with that. And these are exactly the types of things that they talk about, which are what are the best practices and how do you get it, get at that the right way. I'm also a big supporter, and I've seen major improvement in more communication on information on firm engagement leadership. I've seen that go a long, long way since 2005. One of the things I wanted to address, though, is the question in our materials if communications are boilerplate. And having attended various audit committee meetings of different companies, this is my impression. It may be right, it may be wrong, but I'll open it up. I believe it's true that some of the terminology is recurring given what is in the requirement, and within each firm they tend to use the same form of slides for the communication. But I do not think the substance of the communication is boilerplate from what I have seen with various audit committees. I am not aware of any empirical data that says the communications are boilerplate. So if anyone here has that data, I would love to see it or hear it. I did try to do research, and I did call up a couple of people that are knowledgeable in this area, and they didn't give it to me, although I do know in 205 that was something that was discussed. Page 5 and 8 note that the existing standard requires the auditor to communicate the process for management's estimates and the process the auditor uses to reach its conclusion. To me, the follow-up question for the accounting committee is, well, what did you find? And certainly if they don't ask that question, then someone else in the room needs to prod them to ask that. But I see audit committees asking that question, what did you find? And as Jamie said, there are some very interesting discussions that have ensued from that question, what did you find? And this is query, is this best answered and addressed with the audit committee through dialogue and not being prescriptive? I certainly believe, like Jamie, that there should be strong encouragement that the audit committee and auditor engage in dialogue on this issue. And I think there should be a lot of emphasis in that area. You know, I apologize in advance. I am a lawyer. I tried to hide it, but I'm not sure when I see written communications, you know, I start seeing a little bit of red. I'm not sure written communication would produce better results. These are inherently highly judgmental areas. And I question if a required written communication would actually become boilerplate to limit a hindsight review and those damn lawyers. So that based on a lot of accounting committee discussions, that's something I'm concerned about. One suggestion that was not in here that I think you may want to consider is it might be helpful to accounting committees to consider what significant new auditing items have been noted in this year's audit as compared to prior fiscal year's audit, because I think there's also have been a lot of really robust discussions when audit committees have asked that question.
Thank you, Peggy. And Lynn, would you mind going next?
I'd be pleased to. This reminds me, this discussion has been going on since the late 30s, early 40s, when the SEC initially came out and recommended, as a result of McKesson-Robbins, that we have audit committees. And then in 1978, the New York Stock Exchange, for the first time, adopted rules talking about the independence of the audit committee. And then when I was at the commission, we got into and undertook the initiatives that developed many of the rules that are in place today, much of which, quite frankly, couldn't have been done without the unbelievable support of Peggy Foran in the Blue Ribbon Panel on Audit Committees. She has been probably the strongest voice I have ever seen for investors in this area, so kudos to Peggy. But when we formed the Blue Ribbon Panel and came out with the recommendations that it did do, it was limited at the time. I remember a meeting in the co-chair's offices in New York City where we did sit around the table with some members of the committee and knew we couldn't go further than what we did because already Peggy and her CEO at Pfizer, Bill Steer, had done everything they could do to keep the business community on board with us, and many were opposing what we were doing on audit committees at the time, and to go any further would have probably cratered the whole process. It would have been cratered well before that and had been for Peggy, Bill Steers, and their CFO, David Shedlars. So we did what we could at the time and really put in place this notion of this three-legged stool that you had to have management along with the auditors, internal and external, and as well as the audit committee all in the room together. And we really had to beef up the communication, and we had to get into talking about not just whether things were acceptable, but whether they were really the right thing the way they were. And so the recommendations did come out. When we put those recommendations out, though, we urge people not to turn them into boilerplate disclosures to investors. And unfortunately, the first thing that happened was the audit committees turned over the drafting of the audit committee report to the attorneys. And so based on my experience of literally reviewing hundreds, if not thousands, of these reports over the years, they are truly boilerplate and have not really lived up to expectations. They do provide more information than what investors were getting, but in terms of really meaningful information to investors, given the boilerplate, not all, but certainly many of them don't provide the value that we were looking for at that point in time. And in fact, there's a group of these, a sizable group of them, where it looks like the attorneys are seeing how few words they can actually use and still meet the mandatory minimum requirements. You also get some of that boilerplate out of the auditors. In the various SASs, they say, here is what we got to communicate to audit committees. And so on a number of audit committees, I've seen auditors slip into the same type of boilerplate reporting. You'll get the same set of slides or the same letter, and it just basically lists out the basic things and say nothing significant, A-OK, whatever. But it isn't very robust, and it certainly isn't the type of disclosures that we heard investors were looking for on the Treasury Committee in getting behind the numbers on what's going on and what does the auditor honestly think about it. Instead, too often, I think if you look at the audit committee packages, it is just pretty much boilerplate from the auditors in that respect. As a member of an audit committee, Marty was asking me some if I had talked about some of the things that we do, and I agree with Peggy that these audit committees are significantly different from audit committee to audit committee. There are some that are really engaged, and that includes people that aren't necessarily CPAs. I've seen some outstanding members of audit committees that are good business people, and they translate that into really an understanding of the financials, some probing on the tough questions. It's more not only do they know the business, but do they have the ability and spine and the personality to challenge and question and probe in a thoughtful, meaningful fashion. Also considering, though, that you've got to have this three-legged stool and everyone's got to be working together to really get out a good set of financial statements. With that, each year as we go into the beginning of the audit, and I've been blessed by having two of the firms around the table here as our auditors, fortunately, and they've done a good job, but we go in and we talk about the scope, of course, but we get the auditors to give us and provide us information and a schedule, and down the left-hand side of the schedule is their people, partner, manager, senior, whatever, and across the top are all the significant areas. And I typically ask them to identify the top five risk areas in the business from their perspective and give me the hours and who's going to be doing the hours in that. I like to see whether or not I'm getting enough hours out of the top level people in the firm who have the most experience and knowledge as opposed to just people throwing staff at it. And I also get a very good feeling. We just changed the auditor on one of the outfits, and I don't think our auditor was doing a very good job, and it really showed up when we got the schedule at him, because you could just tell the numbers had just been plugged in, just something to give the audit committee rather than a real thoughtful process with respect to are we getting the hours where we need to be, et cetera. Interestingly enough, that partner couldn't really explain some things about key assumptions and judgments to the audit committee very well as well in some areas, including fair value valuations. But so we get this breakdown of how they're spending the hours, who's spending the hours, and how are those hours going to be divvied up, including to the top five risk areas at the beginning of the audit. We also ask at the beginning of each audit for anything about that may impair the independence. We go through calls during the course of the audit. I've always had great feedback from the auditors, not only at the beginning and end, but if anything pops up, we want to make sure that they tell us. We tell them, you know, no surprises. If something pops up, call us right off the bat. And they've been superb at that. Then as we get down to the completion of the audit, we ask the auditors to come back in and in their presentation to us talk about those top five risk areas again, which, by the way, at the beginning of the audit, we ask management then to tell us their opinion of the top five risk areas, and we see if everyone's on the same page. So we've got management, auditors, and an audit committee, and in some circumstances, I've seen where members of the audit committee who are very good in business challenge the auditors and actually challenge management and highlight what I thought were some very good risk areas that management and the auditors hadn't focused on, and we redirected some of the audit in those situations. We ask them and we probe into the significant judgments and assessments, including some of the audit committee members, again, who have experience, have really probed the auditors on their work on auditing fair values. Certainly a big item for us in the mutual funds. And so that's been a good area. We probe about adjustments. We've basically taken the policy that if it's a significant adjustment, don't put the auditor in the position of having to put it on a scorecard. Just get it booked, and that's worked out relatively well with the CFO. We ask them then to come back to that original schedule and tell us whether or not there were changes in the original schedule as to where they thought they were going to have to spend their hours and who spent the hours versus how they actually ended up spending the hours and whether or not there was a change in scope or whether or not that really tells us whether there was a change in scope, whether or not there was a problem, a significant problem that popped up and really highlights it out for us. We get a chart from the auditor on accounting policies, and we really started this, quite frankly, when Randy's firm was our auditors, and they did a marvelous job. They came in and they took each of our significant accounting policy areas, and they gave us a chart that had aggressive on one end and conservative on the other end. And we wedded it with the concept that Greg Jonas brought up several years ago about turning this in a golf course. We said on one side, is one side of the golf course and on one side's the other, aggressive and conservative, and we quite frankly never wanted to be out in the rough, you know. And we wanted to stay in the middle. But we then wanted the audit partner to come and tell us his opinion on really where we were in each of the areas. So each year now we've gotten a chart back from the audit partner saying where do they think we are. And in one of the audits this last year, it was interesting because one of the audit committee members had a real problem with that chart. And the audit partner, and I think they've done a marvelous job of coming in and saying, here's where I really think you are. And one of the audit committee members said, well, you're not all the way over to conservative. And he said, no. He says, that's not necessarily a good thing to always be over on the conservative side. And yet this audit committee member had this concept in her mind that unless you're over on that conservative column, and so we had to go through an education process with the audit committee member and also remind her that this was not what she thought. This is what we want the auditor partner to tell us what they thought. It really got back to what's in the Blue Ribbon panel recommendations. But that chart that Randy's firm came up with has just been superb, and we found worked very good. We go through what's referred to at time as the Buffett questions. As we were doing the Blue Ribbon panel on audit committees, Warren Buffett sent us a letter that was just a superb letter. Unfortunately, it came in towards the end of the process, so we didn't have the opportunity to put it into rulemaking. But Buffett then did use it when he was chairing the audit committee at Coca-Cola. And in fact, in the first year, I've been told by people at Coca-Cola, in the first year of compliance with the new audit committee communication disclosure rules, the attorneys drafted the communication for the audit committee, and Warren didn't like it at all. So he then turned around and drafted his own, which is what ended up in the proxy. And if you look at Coca-Cola's proxy, they've continued that, and they actually document and communicate some real good information to investors, and they cover four or five questions, which include, the first one is, in essence, if the auditor were preparing these financial statements on their own, would they have changed any numbers? Second one is, given what the auditor knows about the business today and they were investing in this company, would they want any further disclosures that have not been made? Are there any additional disclosures that you would ask for? And the third one is, if you were CFO, would you turn around and change any of the internal controls of the company? He's got another one about assistance. Did you get all the assistance, cooperation you need? And then one on revenue recognition at times specifically. And when you think about it, they are excellent questions. And there are also questions that if you got the wrong answer to, any audit committee should be concerned about. So we have gone through those questions. And, you know, the first time you ask an auditor to do that, I can tell you, we got the audit partner rolled the eyes a little bit at us, like, are you nuts? But we've gone back and pointed to what Coke did. And after we got through the first year or two, it went actually very quite well. And so we have subsequently then been disclosing as an audit committee that we've had those discussions with the auditor. And in one instance, though, we started to get comments back from investors, which was amazing. I thought we'd never get a letter back from an investor on an audit committee report, but all of a sudden we started getting letters from investors in one situation saying, well, you say you asked the auditor these questions. What were the answers? You know, and so we had to start dropping in a line. We did start dropping in a line that said we got the responses back, and the responses were all considered appropriate by the audit committee. And there's only one answer that's appropriate. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer as to what that answer is. But, and we do document asking those questions in the audit committee minutes, and we do document the answers. And that's worked out well for us. It's worked out well for Coca-Cola. It certainly has provided investors additional information when we went through the internal control stuff for the first time, 404. We also disclosed a lot more and had a lot more discussions around internal controls and disclosed in the audit committee report that information. We've always talked about the PCLB inspection reviews and gone through that and got the firms to respond to any concerns of the PCLB. We do at the audit committees evaluate the auditor, and we ask the auditor to come back and evaluate the audit committee and ask them if we're doing what we need to do. And at times they've provided some excellent feedback to us. The other thing that we get into in recent years was a number of years ago there was a study that came out of the forensic accounting group that I thought was excellent. And it highlighted how data shows that frauds are almost never found by internal auditors or external auditors, and that most of those are brought to someone's attention either through a hotline tip or through a surprise audit. And, of course, the O'Malley panel urged more on the surprise audit side, but little has been done with that. So what we did was, in the case of one of our audits since the beginning, we've always had them bring in a forensic-type guy and make him a part of the team, and that's worked out well. But a couple years ago, we specifically asked that member of the team to, as part of the audit, start looking at and gain an understanding of our hotline, whether or not it was truly independent, because I'd seen a number of hotlines. For example, in one public company, I found the hotline reported back to the general counsel, which means it's not independent. No employee is ever going to use it, so you can forget about that ever detecting anything until there's a blow-up. So we asked them to get in there, look at it, see if it worked as it should work, and see if it was truly independent and would provide us that detection measure with respect to fraud that it has been proven and demonstrated that it was. We've now made that part of our audits. And at the end of the year, at the completion, the auditor comes back and tells us whether or not, in fact, that thing has been working. I found that beneficial. I found it troubling that in a couple cases, the first go-around, the audit partner could not explain to me anything about the hotline. And given that that's the way most things are found, it's troubling that an audit partner wouldn't know that, wouldn't know how it functions, how it works. And so that's become, in the case where we just changed auditors, that was, again, a request we made at the audit partner, that the audit partner go back and, as part of the audit, dig into that and then come back and provide us feedback on that. My audit committee members have also asked for, it's strange, they asked for more information in one year and less information in the next year, and it's kind of a ongoing tug and debate. They'll ask for more information about out of the audit firms that on updating things, even in cases where I think the audit firms have done a marvelous job, audit firms will provide it all to them, and then the next year they'll be back to, you're filling up my email box, I'm getting too much, can you cut it back? So I think that's kind of a normal tug and take that you often see with audit committees and is not unusual because these are very, very busy people. The other thing we do is that we do call and talk throughout the year a number of times when there aren't regular audit committee meetings just to catch up if there's something significant going on with the entity. I have called up the auditor just to make sure that they stay appraised. I think it's important they hear right up front from the CFO and from the audit committee chair if there's been any new developments. And sometimes the CFO has made the first call and sometimes I have, but I think that that type of communication back and forth is throughout the year is very important. So that's what some of the things are that we've done that seem to have worked well.
Thank you, Lynn.